This Star News Media podcast is presented by North Chase Family Dentistry. Open evenings, Saturdays, and they probably take your insurance. Visit them on the web at northchasefamilydentistry.com. And by Tide Water Heating and Air Conditioning, servicing all major brands with highly trained technicians who are the best the industry has to offer, serving Wilmington and surrounding communities for more than 40 years. Learn more at TidewaterAC.com.
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, the podcast exploring the persisting legends, historical oddities, and landmark stories of southeastern North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Hunter Ingram, and I'm a reporter with the Star News here in Wilmington. I'm coming to you today from a pretty scary time in the world, one that I think many of us are still trying to wrap our heads around. As I record this, North Carolina is under a month-long stay-at-home lockdown in an effort to stop the increasingly rapid and widespread infection rate of the coronavirus, also known as COVID-19. Across the state, schools are shut down, businesses are shuttered, restaurants can only serve takeout to customers, and our recreational haunts that we once visited habitually, like gyms and movie theaters, are closed indefinitely. And for the first time in this show's history, I'm recording this episode from my bedroom instead of our podcast studio in the Star News offices. In so many ways, our daily lives have come to a halt as the country battles an invisible and extremely contagious enemy, the very notion of which is still a pretty surreal concept to fathom. But this isn't the first time the United States and the rest of the world has seen its daily routines sidelined amid panic over and preparation for a global health crisis. You have to go back more than a century, but in 1918, the country was plunged into a reality that's very reminiscent of what we're dealing with today. Closed businesses, a strained economy, and a heightened sense of fear. The Spanish influenza of 1918 would become a devastatingly deadly pandemic, killing an estimated 50 million people worldwide. It touched every community, and it's very likely that every person felt the pain of its tragedy in one way or another. In southeastern North Carolina, the influenza arrived in Wilmington before it advanced across the state, killing thousands. With so many people and families quarantined at home today while the world fights to mitigate the threat of the coronavirus, it affords us an opportunity to look back at the past and recognize its eerie parallels to the present. What can be learned from the outbreak of 1918? What measures were taken to contain the influenza then? And how did the Spanish Lady, as it was called, bring the Cape Fear region to a standstill? We'll talk about all of it and more in this special quarantine episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, as we share the story of Wilmington and the 1918 Spanish influenza. Wilmington got its first, and for some, only warning of the impending Spanish flu disaster from a small article on the front page of the September 14th, 1918 edition of the Wilmington Morning Star. It spoke of an outbreak among soldiers at Fort Morgan in Alabama, mentioned a few cases springing up in Boston and New York, and warned that those infected could already be on the streets or working in factories and offices in cities across the country. Although the article encouraged increased caution, it gives no indication that health professionals knew the scope of what was to come. In 1918, Wilmington existed in a sweet spot of prosperity and notoriety. It was an industrial port town with 30,000 or so residents, many of whom were employed at shipbuilding yards, the Atlantic Coastline Railroad, and on farms that produced world-class exports such as cotton. When the workday was done, the region offered its residents and visitors all the natural amenities of the beach and the river, with man-made luxuries such as Lumina Pavilion and the Oceanic Hotel in Wrightsville Beach. Wilmington had become a sought-after destination for so many: traders, culture seekers, business magnates, and admirers. And in a way, it was that steady stream of visitors in and out of the region that likely brought the Spanish influenza to the shores of the Cape Fear. In the fall of 1918, the only topic of conversation among the citizens of Wilmington, and the world for that matter, was the latest from the front lines of World War I. They didn't know it yet, but the four-year global struggle was reaching its end. Armistice Day and the official surrender of the German powers was just around the corner on November 11th. But in the grip of war, the world let its guard down to other threats, especially those that didn't come charging on the battlefield. A symptom of a global war is the constant movement of troops from one place to another, allowing divergent cultures to brush up against one another for the first time, and contagions to latch onto people like invisible baggage. While the source of the influenza has never been definitively determined, it's almost certain that the constant transport of soldiers on both sides helped spread the virus to every corner of the globe. Regardless of where it started, the Spanish influenza would come in waves. The first American cases were reported at a Kansas military base in March 1918. However, mild symptoms and no widespread transmission caused people to chalk it up to something similar to the common cold, and it was quickly written off by the time spring arrived. But by the fall, it returned with a vengeance. The first case in Wilmington was reported on September 19th, 1918. 2 days later, William Wright, a 29-year-old husband and father, became what is believed to have been its first local victim. He died within days of his first symptoms. Wright's young age was one of the growing pandemic's defining traits. Unlike many viruses that target the elderly and the immunocompromised, the Spanish influenza's mortality rate was unusually high in healthy adults, ages 20 to 40, according to the Centers for Disease Control. As soon as it was first reported to have arrived in Wilmington, it seemed as though the flu spread almost instantaneously. On September 20th, the Wilmington Morning Star announced 30 local cases of the Spanish grip, another one of its nicknames, and those had just arisen in the past 36 hours. 2 days later, it surged to 100 cases, with no race or class spared. By September 24th, it was nearly 500 cases. Similar to what we've seen with the slow advance of the coronavirus across the globe in 2020, skepticism was high among the 1918 general population as to just how serious they should take a threat that they couldn't actually see. But if the case numbers didn't alarm people, firsthand accounts of the troubling symptoms being seen at local hospitals should have. Blinding headaches that caused hallucinations and fevers that shot well above 104 degrees were among the most common symptoms. Some people turned blue from a lack of oxygen as the flu attacked their lungs. And if it wasn't cutting off their oxygen, It was filling their overworked lungs with fluids. And many victims were regularly coughing up blood. It was a brutal disease. And perhaps even more terrifying was how quickly it moved. Some people experienced their first symptoms one day and were dead within 48 hours. An editorial in the newspaper encouraged residents to heed warnings and not to act as though an unseen enemy is a harmless one. Quote, "The general public has not fully realized the seriousness of the situation," it is declared, "and many will not until it is brought home to them by actual contact." End quote. Unfortunately, it wouldn't take long for nearly every family in Wilmington to feel the pressure of the Spanish grip. By late September, the cases locally were doubling by the day, and the city began to act. Initially, the local health director had encouraged people to keep 6 feet of distance between themselves and anyone with symptoms. He also discouraged the use of public fountains and the sharing of cups and clothes. But within a week, more drastic measures had to be taken. Those industries that had helped put Wilmington on the country's radar, like the Atlantic Coastline Railroad and the shipyards, fell silent as workers began coming down with symptoms. 1 week after the city saw its first 100 cases, it now had more than 1,000 by September 28th. To try and mitigate the spread, local health officials shut down movie theaters, churches, bars, and any form of public gathering. That's probably starting to sound a lot like our current situation with the coronavirus. The beginning of the 1918-1919 school year was also delayed indefinitely. And some of those vacant schools now became hospitals, as the city's main medical center, James Walker Memorial Hospital, was already overrun with patients. An article in the Morning Star put it this way, quote, "Every man who sneezed wondered if he might be catching Spanish influenza, which is feared worse than the draft," end quote. In just a matter of days, a bustling city had ground to a halt, its streets barren and its residents afraid to go outside. Wilmington became a ghost town, something that calls to mind stories from the yellow fever epidemic of 1862, when another disease took hold of the community within days. That was also a time of war, as Union and Confederate forces locked horns on battlefields across the country. But in Wilmington, 1,500 of the city's 10,000 residents would become infected with yellow fever, and more than 650 would die from it. As Wilmington grappled with the Spanish influenza in 1918, it was cut off from its surrounding cities, just as it had been in 1862, out of fear that if residents fled to other cities, they might take the disease with them. The city was virtually on lockdown by October 1918, which proved to be the deadliest month of the disease. The death rate in Wilmington would increase daily, sometimes by more than 10. Oakdale Cemetery, which had opened up a public burial ground for victims of the yellow fever in 1862, suddenly found itself the epicenter of burials again. Each day, several people would be laid to rest, some in hastily constructed pine boxes that took the place of coffins, which were in short supply. One of the most heartbreaking stories to arise from the pandemic in Wilmington, that of a young couple, ends at Oakdale. As told in a multi-part series written by Cheryl Welch for the Star News in 2006, Rudolph and Henrietta Giestchen were living the kind of life that 20-something couples dreamed of. He was a successful teller at a local bank, another one of Wilmington's thriving industries. She had their first child in 1914, and their second had just arrived. He was happy when the banks closed down amid the outbreak. It meant more time at home with his growing family, and less chance that he would bring the flu to his own doorstep. Unfortunately, the couple still caught the bug. On October 1st, Welch says that Henrietta began having chills. A few days later, Rudolph developed a cough. After several days confined to their house, battling increasingly taxing symptoms, he died on October 7th. 2 days later, she joined him on what would have been their 6th wedding anniversary. Their 2 children, the youngest of which wasn't even a month old, had become orphans in less than a week, left to be raised by their grandmother, Granny Fick. The loss of a young couple in good health and good standing hit the Wilmington community hard, and it put into perspective the toll that the pandemic could have. As we've seen with the spread of the coronavirus, no one is immune to its rampage. Not the rich and powerful, not the poor and penniless. Across the state, the Spanish influenza claimed telephone operators and doctors alike, wealthy socialites and middle-class factory workers. That's what fed into the fear. And that's what also concerns people today as we face the coronavirus. A sickness like the Spanish influenza or COVID-19 doesn't adhere to the barriers and borders by which we define our lives. They are equal opportunity enemies and should be prepared for as such. As fear took hold and the illness spread in 1918, rumors of just how the disease came to town began running rampant in Wilmington. Welch wrote that people questioned if this was all a biological attack by the Germans who snuck into town from a U-boat off the coast. Or was it the result of tainted medical supplies? People wanted answers, because a definitive source on which to cast blame is a lot easier to swallow than the realization that we're always going to be at the mercy of such diseases. It's estimated that upwards of 10,000 people were infected with Spanish influenza in Wilmington. Most battled the symptoms and lived to tell their grandchildren about that horrible fall in 1918 when the city was stricken with panic and plague. Wilmington would start to see relief by mid-October, as new cases dwindled from the triple digits to just 20 or 30 a day. Although transmission had slowed, people were still left to fight the disease, and some would still die from it. Schools finally began their academic year on October 25th, though many parents waited a few days before sending their children. Theaters and bars reopened quickly to give people an outlet and escape after weeks of isolated panic. Most accounts of the Spanish influenza refer to its end much like its beginning, sudden and mysterious. Was it the cold weather of the winter that did it in? Or as Welch puts it, did it run out of people to infect? In total, Wilmington lost more than 230 of its own to the Spanish lady, more than half of whom died in the first 2 weeks of October. But that was just a fraction of her almost unfathomable death toll. At least 20% of the entire population of North Carolina was infected by the disease, with nearly 14,000 dying from the mountains to the coast. In the United States, the bodies continued to pile up through the spring of 1919, totaling more than 675,000 dead. And worldwide, the influenza killed at least 50 million people, and it infected 500 million, one-third of the entire population of the planet. As we wade through the uncertainty of the coronavirus pandemic, each day can feel like a week in the amount of news that comes at us and then changes by the hour. But imagine how it was in 1918, when technology didn't deliver us hourly death tolls in the corners of our screens. They had to wait for news, wait for relief, and wait for the crisis to pass. But what's important to remember is that it did. Life in Wilmington returned to normal. The shipyards resumed production. The coal burned once again at the Atlantic Coastline Railroad, and farms got back to their harvest. Even medical professionals turned their focus back to the war effort. Wilmington and the world weathered the storm, and we'll do it again. But if anything should be learned from the 1918 pandemic, it is that saving lives is on all of us. We should treat events like the coronavirus with a degree of caution and preparedness, as if it were the next 1918 Spanish influenza. Because you never know. It very well could be. That's it for this special episode of Cape Fear Unearthed. Thank you so much for joining me. The podcast will return with regularly scheduled episodes soon. But until then, please take the appropriate precautions to protect yourselves and your loved ones as we all get through this crisis together. And while you have a lot of downtime, please make sure that you're a member of our Facebook group, because I've got some fun things planned until the show returns. In that group, listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own memories of the region's history. There, you will also find updates on when the show will be back and what we're doing during this hiatus. If you have episode ideas or questions about the show, you can also email me directly at capefearunearthed@gmail.com. And don't forget to sign up for the Cape Fear Unearthed newsletter, which goes out every week. In it, I include links to all of our new episodes and any supplemental pictures or videos that I uncover in my research, all delivered right to your inbox. Sign up for that newsletter at starnewsonline.com/newsletters. As always, you can find a list of all the books, articles, and resources used in researching this podcast in the show notes of each episode. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by me, Hunter Ingram. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com or on Twitter at Hunter_Wesley. Additional editing is done by Adam Fish. This podcast was made possible by listeners and readers like you. Support local journalism and Cape Fear Unearthed by subscribing to the Star News today at starnewsonline.com/subscribe. And there's never a better time to support local journalism than in situations like the coronavirus, when local communities need a trusted and reliable news source to get them all the information that comes in each day for themselves and their families. And while you're out subscribing to things, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, leave us a review, which will help more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Until next time, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. But please, do it at a safe distance. While you're out, you never know what you might unearth.